This is the second day of this April 2009 seven-day session. We'll resume reading from our text from yesterday, the book called The Way of Korean Zen by Kusan Sunim, the 20th century Korean master. We read his biography yesterday, and now we'll wade into his first, it's called Instructions for Meditation. And this is specifically about koan meditation. Actually, the title of this section is Huadu Meditation. And Huadu means the nub of the koan. So in the case of Mu, the whole case involves the monk asking Joshu, does even a dog have Buddha nature, and so forth. The Huadu, or the nub, the kernel of it, is just the word Mu. And throughout the text, he uses this word Huadu, but I'm just going to substitute koan for Huadu. Human beings are said to be superior to all other creatures. But how can a human being be considered superior if he knows his body but is ignorant of the nature of his mind? One who knows the body but not the mind is an incomplete person. However, if a human being searches for the mind and awakens to it, he will realize completeness, for at that time he will know both the body and the mind. I think this is not the best way of articulating this. He's distinguishing body from the mind that one realizes through awakening, but I would propose that it's on the one hand there's the body mind, those two are inseparable, this body mind complex that we call I. There's that's what many people are very familiar with. It's not just the body, it's the body mind. But then this what we awaken to is that which is beyond the body mind. We can call it mind with a capital M, true mind, true self. But always when we read body, I would say it includes the mind with a small m, the ordinary discriminating mind. Anyway, the point is that we're not complete until we have realized that which is beyond our ordinary body-mind concept. He goes on. Upon awakening, this world becomes a pure land. But as long as you are only concerned with the body and enslaved by the environment, this world will remain as a defiled realm. Enslaved by the environment, meaning as long as we are caught in our reactions to things, to our reactions to changes that are happening, to the circumstances we find ourselves in, reactions to other people, then we're not free. One of the most important benefits or dividends that comes out of sesshin practice is learning to not react to the fluctuations in our concentration. These fluctuations are just part of having a body mind. There are times when we're more alert and times when we're more drowsy, times when we're more concentrated, times when we're less concentrated, times when we're not feeling as well physically, something may be going on, or physical pain comes and goes, and half of the secret to moving through sesshin effectively is to learn not to react to these ups and downs, these changes, but just hold fast to the practice in the midst of the changes. Even something as ordinary as the changes in the weather is something that many people in this world get all upset about. It's one of the many little signs that one's practice is maturing when one doesn't react to the weather either way. When it's gorgeous spring, beautiful day, one doesn't get giddy and crazy. And on the other hand, when we have this typical Rochester weather, cold rain and slushy snow and all that, we don't make a huge thing out of it. It's one thing to with some bemusement comment on the weather when it's awful, or to just enjoy it when it's good. But the problem comes, as always, with the clinging to our reactions and just getting stuck. He goes on, the purpose of practicing Zen meditation is to awaken to the mind. The purpose of practicing Zen meditation is to awaken to the mind. You would never hear that in most Soto Zen centers, which are most Zen centers in the West and in Japan. By far, numerically, they're far the vast majority of Zen centers and temples and monasteries in the West and in Asia are Soto centers. And they wouldn't be caught dead making this statement, because they are so convinced that if you speak of awakening, then you're violating this reality that is beyond these designations, awakening and non-awakening and so forth. But this is one of the things I love about Kusan Sunim. He doesn't shrink from acknowledging the great opportunity we have as human beings. What is said in Buddhism to be a unique opportunity from the human body-mind to come to awakening, to awaken to this self-nature, to the nature of reality, same thing. And he just lays it out there. The purpose of practicing Zen meditation is to awaken to the mind. Such practice does not involve just sitting quietly and trying to calm and pacify the mind. This is a constant danger in Zazen and most obvious in Sesshin, where we can find that over the course of the early days of Sesshin, we can find ourselves settling into a state of calm, of quiescence, and it's all too easy to just hunker down and settle for settling. But it's such a it's so limited as to what we can experience through this practice, just to become deeply calm. It's wonderful. It's a lot better than having the mind agitated, as it may normally be in our stress-driven lives. But it can't begin to measure up to the real possibility at hand. It's a first step. When we come into Sesshin, the mind tends to be relatively agitated, restless, and fragmented, and disconnected, and in a state of unrest. So first, we have to let it settle, and it takes plenty of work just to do that. But once we can, when it reaches that's a stillness, relative stillness, then comes the real possibility, which is to see into the mind, truly to see into and through the mind. So he says it does not involve just sitting quietly and so forth. Instead, it involves direct inquiry into a koan. An example of a koan would be a question such as, what is this? Or, what is this mind? What you are searching for can be called by many different names: mind, spirit, soul, true nature, and so forth. But such designations are merely labels. You should put aside all of these names and reflect on the fact that the true master of the body is more than just the label mind. The master of the body is not Buddha, for it is not yet awakened. In other words, there might be those who say, well, our Buddha mind, our true mind, is the master. But that's just talk. Says, don't call that notion the master until you go beyond it as a notion and experience it for yourself. Nor is it anything material, because it cannot be physically given away or received. Nor is it simply empty space, for empty space cannot pose questions or have knowledge of good and evil. Hence, there is a master who rules this body, who is neither the label mind, the Buddha, a material thing, nor empty space. Having negated these four possibilities, a question will arise as to what this master really is. Well, master, let me just interject that master is not something I think that would would be a way that most Westerners would articulate this, the master. I think it reflects the Asian orientation toward hierarchy. I don't know, maybe it would to some. I've never really heard anyone pose it that way in Doksan. I think it's enough just to have this question, what is this? What is this mind? Who am I? If you continue inquiring in this way, the questioning will become more intense. Finally, when the mass of questioning enlarges to a critical point, it will suddenly burst. The entire universe will be shattered, and only your original nature will appear before you. In this way, you will awaken. When he says the entire universe will be shattered, of course, he doesn't mean in any physical, literal way, but our world as we have known it, which is a world that is steeped in concepts, ideas, abstractions. That world of abstraction, that universe, that dry world of abstraction will be shattered. And then we see our original face. We see things as they are. The direct experience. Most people who aren't practicing anyway, most people have no idea of how much their perception of reality, of life, is abstract. It's how much of it is ideas. When we finally see through this whole paradigm of ideas, then we, for the first time, are really fully alive. It is most important to continuously investigate the koan with unswerving determination. At the beginning, you might feel as though you are trying to lift a heavy bucket full of water with a weak arm. Even so, you should never relax your effort. Instead, no matter what you are doing, be solely concerned with nothing but the koan. If a clock were unreliable and kept stopping, any sensible person would either have it repaired or get rid of it. Similarly, when practicing meditation, you must exert continuous effort and not allow yourself to be lazy. So this is one of the major features of practice that make it so difficult, is the sense that we are ineffectual in our efforts, that we're just not getting anywhere. And that's a key test of faith. When we feel like our efforts are inadequate, that we're not getting anywhere, that we just can't seem to begin to keep the practice in our mind, some people will become so frustrated that they just quit. It's a very, very important test of one's faith, because you have to draw from faith in the process, that even though I feel like I'm not doing much of anything, I'm just weary and feel not the least bit up to the task, even though I feel that way, that if I just do my best, make my strongest effort, then something will come of it. When he says you must exert continuous effort, notice he's not saying you must succeed every round. No, effort. That's all. There's no need to grade yourself about how you're doing. Just make the effort. And that will bring results, as long as you're not thinking about results. Zen Master Dogen referred to practice as a practice of continuous failure. At every stage of practice, it's failing again and again and again. We have to accommodate ourselves to that. We have to, in other words, we have to get beyond notions of success and failure. We have to get beyond notions of progress or lack of progress. I think most people don't realize how much time they waste thinking about their practice. Not concentrating on it, not concentrating on the koan or the breath, but stepping back and thinking conceptually about my practice. My practice is going well. My practice is not going well. My practice surely isn't as good as other people's practice. My practice must be better than other people's practice. That's the concept. It's a concept, my practice. Meanwhile, you're ignoring your breath and your koan. You're just thinking about yourself and your practice. This is a huge, huge common obstacle. And it takes time for most of us. It takes time to notice when we're thinking about our practice instead of just doing the practice. The difference between those two is incalculable. It's monumental. The difference between really just doing it, just what, or just the breathing. That's the practice itself. And then there's this other thing where we're wasting our time evaluating ourselves, judging ourselves, comparing ourselves. He goes on, in Zen meditation, the key factor is to maintain a constant sense of questioning. He's referring to the koan practice, of course. So, having taken hold of the koan, what is this? By the way, what is this is the, I'm told, is the most common breakthrough koan in Korean Zen. It's what most people start with rather than mu. So, having taken hold of the koan, what is this? Try to always sustain the questioning. What is seeing? What is hearing? What is moving these hands and feet? And so on. Before the initial sense of questioning fades, it is important to give rise to the question again. In this way, the process of questioning can continue uninterrupted with each new question overlapping the previous one. Let me just comment on this. This is a certain technique that I never heard of from Roshi Kaplow, and I don't usually advise this, but just because I don't think of it. It's something that anyone can try. I remember when I just sort of discovered it on my own, when I was working on Mu, it did seem to give me a new lease on my practice. The danger with this is getting attached to it and then making it this technique and becoming obsessed with the technique. But what he's describing is where you're, let's say with Mu now, you're exhaling Mu, and before your breath runs out, you just sort of in your mind, you start a new one. So there's a sense of overlapping. The Japanese call this the bamboo method. Bamboo has these knuckles in the stalk, and going from shortening, instead of putting all one's, investing all of one's mind into one, let's say one long exhalation of Mu, and then starting it again, of having this shorter overlapping Mus. And then he adds, in addition, you should try to make this overlapping smooth and regular. But this does not mean that you should just mechanically repeat the question as though it were a mantra. It is useless to just say to yourself day and night, what is this? What is this? What is this? What is this? Or, what is Mu? What is Mu? What is Mu? What is Mu? That's he really is putting his finger on another really fundamental thing. We talked about dwelling in notions of one's practice and progress and so forth. Well, here's another one, is just keeping this sort of mechanical repetition of the word without really being into it, having your mind flitting around here and there, but managing to keep this sort of murmuring going on in one's mind. It just can't compare to really bringing one's mind fully into the awareness of what one is doing. He says the key is to sustain the sense of questioning, not the repetition of the words. Once this inquiry gets underway, there will be no room for boredom. The boredom comes from having the mind split, having one's attention split. You're sort of with the koan, but not really all that much. Your mind is just somewhere else while you're doing it. That is an invitation to boredom. And boredom is a really handy signal that one has to get the whole mind, get more involved with the practice, whether it's a koan or the breath. It means the mind is divided. He goes on, if the mind remains quiet, the koan will not be forgotten and the sense of questioning will continue unbroken. In this way, awakening will be easy. He goes on, while meditating, both wisdom and concentration need to be cultivated in unison. Let's just say something about these two aspects of zazen. These are just other words for what can be called the quiescent aspect, the calming aspect of meditation, on the one hand, and then on the other, the insight aspect, sometimes called wisdom, as he does here. And as many of you have heard me say, these are the two components of a real, viable, true, complete practice of Buddhist meditation. Not just Zen. You hear in Tibetans talk about this too. I first heard this articulated by the Dalai Lama when I was at a conference with him at his place in India. The quieting, the tranquilizing aspect is what many people find they can accomplish in the first half of sesshin, is roughly speaking. That's the preliminary, that's step one, just getting the mind to sit still so we don't have a moving target to try to see into. And then step two is seeing into it. So the very excellent analogy for this is a pond where on a windy day the wind has roiled up the surface of the pond, the waves are choppy or in motion. The first step, this is the pond of course, is mind. The first step is to stop the winds of thought. And from that, the murkiness of the water, the mud in the water will settle and the water will become clear. And then, that's step two, is then seeing into that water, seeing into the mind. So, again, while meditating, both wisdom and concentration need to be cultivated in unison. If there is wisdom without concentration, then mistaken views will increase. And if there is concentration without wisdom, then ignorance will grow. When inquiring single-pointedly into the koan, what is this? The vividness of the koan becomes wisdom, and the cessation of distracted thoughts becomes concentration. Meditation can be compared to a battle between wandering thoughts and dullness of mind on the one hand and the koan on the other. Battle between wandering thoughts and dullness of mind on the one hand side and the koan on the other. In other words, this wandering thoughts and dullness of mind is how many people experience the vacillations of practice. They go from the mind being distracted, restless, agitated, to being sluggish, the torpor in the mind. The stronger the koan becomes, the weaker will become both wandering thoughts and dullness. You are not the first, and you will not be the last to tread this path. So do not become discouraged if you find the practice difficult at times. All the previous patriarchs of old, as well as the contemporary masters, have experienced hardships along this way. Moreover, it is not always the most virtuous or intelligent person who makes the swiftest progress. Sometimes the opposite is true. Well, we can understand that in terms of the most intelligent, because intelligent people often are in the habit of playing with their thoughts. So you could see why that would be an obstacle. But why would he say is not always the most virtuous who make the swiftest progress? Well, he tells us, there are many cases of troublesome and ill-behaved people who, upon turning their attention inward to the practice of meditation, have quickly experienced a breakthrough. So do not feel defeated even before you have really begun. So if you think of yourself as having a big ego, and I know a lot of people do carry around this notion, which is just that, it's just something unnecessary to have this picture of yourself as someone with a special kind of ego, especially big one, hard and active. There's hope for you. There's this old saying in Zen, strong ego, strong spirit. Joseph Goldstein, one of the better known of the Vipassana Buddhist teachers, Joseph Goldstein uses the word for ego. He says we can appreciate it more if we think of a strong ego as a strong mind. I think that's good, because we too easily make the ego into a Buddhist Satan, this agent of evil, of malice and trouble. The problem with that is there's nothing there. Ego is not the devil. It's not some malevolent agent that we're carrying in us. It's just a cluster of thoughts and images. That's all it is. There's no substance to it. There's no little man in here. No little woman in there. It's just a sort of an aggregate of memories, images, thoughts. Nobody there. And the pain of having a strong sense of self, a strong sense of self and other, that's always what that really means, the pain of it offers great fuel for practice. People who've heard these stories of the masters and their struggles, surely you know from what these masters describe, what strong egos they had. I mean, even here yesterday, Kusan Sunin, of his harshness and his making this proud resolution that in 3 months he would finish the job. And then after 3 months, enough of that pride had been scoured away that he was able to recognize that that had been a lot of ego behind that. An ancient master once said that with the passing of the days, you will see your thoughts becoming identical with the koan, and the koan becoming identical with your thoughts. This is quite true. In the final analysis, the practice of Zen can be said to be both the easiest as well as the most difficult thing to do. Well, it's the easiest because basically, there's nothing we need to do. We just need to allow our thoughts to settle. And then look. Look into the practice. But it's the most difficult thing to do that. Because of our habit forces, our mental habit forces of clinging and judging and evaluating, categorizing, analyzing, ruminating. These are powerful habits that we have. However, he says, do not thereby deceive yourself into thinking that it will be either very simple or extremely hard. These are just notions. There is no one who can undertake this task for you. The student's hunger can never be satisfied by his teacher's eating a meal for him. It is like competing in a marathon. The winner will only be the person who is either the fittest or the most determined. It is solely up to the individual to win the race. Likewise, to achieve the aim of your practice, do not be distracted by things that are not related to this task. For the time being, just let everything else remain as it is and put it out of your mind. Just a little quibble here with the translation. We don't even need to put it out of our mind. Putting it is still doing something with it. It is simply absorbing ourselves more and more deeply in the practice, more thoroughly. So deeply always means, it's just another way of saying thoroughly, completely, is by becoming more completely absorbed in our practice that these things on their own will go out of our mind. not our job to put things out of our mind, like taking out the trash. That happens by itself. It just recedes. Thoughts have no roots to them. They just settle like dust if we're not doing anything with them. Well, we're at the end of a chapter, so let's stop here and recite the four vows.